Good morning.
Good morning.
Today is the 6th of May 2008, and I'm now with Mr. Richard Muigbe, who is the Assistant Inspector General for Operations and National Security at the Sierra Leone Police. We are today in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Well, first, thank you for your time.
And you're most welcome.
And before we start the interview, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent to the interview.
I've given my full consent because I realize that this is a very good project, and you are also working together with DPKO UN.
Well, thank you. I'd like to start the interview by asking you a little bit more about your personal background and maybe your history within the Sierra Leone police.
Right. Well, as you heard, my name is Richard Muigbe. I'm the Assistant Inspector General of Police in charge of operations and national security. Well, a little bit about my background in the police. Just after university, Fobe College, in 1987, the 1st of February, I joined the Sierra Leone Police Force as a cadet officer. I went through the training, and at the end of my training, I was what they call on-the-job training for 3 years, going around various formations, the CID, prosecutions, general duties, administration, learning on the job. And after that, I was then confirmed and sent to the CID. And I started work at the anti-smuggling squad for some time. Then I was sent to the forgery and fraud squad, dealing with fraud issues. And from there, the operations department, dealing with robberies and burglaries. And from there, the homicide. So, in fact, I worked in all the areas, the branches of the CID, and I spent most of my time there. And from 1989, I've been working the CID, and then I left there in 1996. I came to police headquarters, and I was given a special task to do a headcount, a census on the police, and I did that. And after that, I was sent to the police training school as a commandant of the training school. I was there for some time, came back to police headquarters. I was in charge of the research and planning department. And after that, I was given a special assignment to be in charge of what they call the Special Investigations Bureau at police headquarters here, to deal with high-profile state investigations and reporting to the Inspector General. And in 1998, the Commonwealth Task Force came, and the police restructuring reform started in Sierra Leone, and with Mr. Kibidu and others, and other experienced officers from all over the world, they came, and then they set up a team at police headquarters here to support the police restructuring team, a senior command team of the police, and I was one of those officers that was nominated. So, in fact, we were a counterpart in the entire restructuring, and now we are managing the changes. So I'm quite experienced and au fait with how a failing force, because by then it was like a force in crisis, how that one was resurrected today to be an envy of the nation and the international community, and even being nicknamed as a force for good. So I have worked in areas of operation, investigation, administration. In fact, at the strategic level here at police headquarters, the AIG position, I was the AIG who set up the discipline department. We call it the Complaint Discipline and Internal Investigations Department. I set up that department, and after that, I worked in the support services for some time, and from there, I went to Police Staff College in England to do the UK Strategic Command Course and the International Strategic Leadership Program, both in the Police Staff College at Bramshill, Scotland, and then Cambridge University, and came back. When I came back, I was tasked again to set up an integrated department that brings together CID, the Criminal Investigations Department, and the Special Branch and the other intelligence assets in the police to be called the Crime Services Department under one strategic leadership. So after setting that department up, AIG Crime Services. I was moved again to Personnel, Welfare and Training Department as AIG in charge, looking after personnel issues, welfare issues, the training issues in the police, both national and international. And on the 10th of January 2006, I was transferred to the Operations Department, where I am still as the substantive head of the police operations. And my responsibilities here really is coordinating all the work of operation and commanders force-wide, coming out with operational policies and direction, and giving strategic focus and direction to all commanders. And I look after operations of national character, like the general elections or high-profile heads of state coming to this country. Anything that is national. I am really tasked. I am in charge of that, ensuring the security and the proper planning and implementation. So briefly, that's about my background in the police service. And maybe to add, last year, amidst the heavy working around the elections, putting the election security, I was also doing a part-time master's in business administration, and I graduated with an MBA last December. Thank you.
Congratulations. So, can you describe a little bit more in detail the history of the setup of the Joint Coordination Center where you're working, how it functions, and what are the different stakeholders in?
Right. Like I was saying, after the war, when constitutional order was restored, in fact, there were reforms both in the police, the military, and then there was a national security sector reform, because what the international community that came to support the government, and also the government reflecting on the old security arrangement in the country before the war, it was found to be really highly flawed. All the institutions working on their own, the police were working on their own, and the military on their own. And in fact, it was only the military and the police that were considered to be security institutions. So institutions like immigration, other ministries, departments, and agencies, they were considered to have nothing to do with security at all. But the reform considered that for you to have a holistic national security, even the Ministry of Finance has a stake, because when you plan operations, for you to carry out the activities, they have resource implication, funding implication. So it was at that point they started recognizing the importance of other institutions. So there was this national security sector reform, and that reform brought about a new national security architecture. Now, the new national security architecture, which is all-inclusive, bringing together the police, the military, the international agencies here, like UNOSIL, IMAT, certain ministries, departments, and agencies. Now, at the highest level, I'll start from there before I come down to the Joint Coordination Center, which I chair. At the highest level in the new security architecture in this country, which is governed by an act of parliament, they call it the Central Intelligence and Security Act of 2002, it establishes the following architecture organogram. At the highest level, which we call the platinum in security terms, the platinum, and that platinum also has two layers. That is the National Security Council, NSC, and then the National Security Council Coordinating Group, NSCCG. Now the NSC brings membership from all ministries, departments, and agencies that have something to do with security, like Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Finance, Internal Security, and then the head of the police, the Inspector General, the Chief of Defense Staff for the military. They meet monthly at State House, and it is the President himself that chairs the National Security Council meeting. They meet as and when need be, but under normal situation is monthly they meet. And when they deliberate on security issues about the country, the outcome is a policy security directive or decision, a policy security directive or decision. That is the outcome of their deliberation, looking at all the issues, either food or education, how that impacts on security, and the outcome is a policy decision which they take. Now they pass that policy decision to the next layer within the platinum, which is the NSCCG, that's the National Coordinating Council Group. And this is chaired by a retired Brigadier, Kelly Conte. We meet fortnightly on Tuesdays at State House. And the membership also is drawn from the police, from the military, from other ministries, departments and agencies, from UN, from IMAT. And we meet fortnightly at State House. Representing the police is the Inspector General and the AIG Operations, and that is myself, and my counterpart in the military, the Joint Force Commander and the Chief of Defense Staff. So we meet and deliberate on this security policy decision or directive handed down to this body by the National Security Council. So at this level again, the final outcome is operational policy directive. And this operational policy directive or decision here is then passed to what I will call the operational wing of these two layers, these policy decision layers. And that is the National Operations Center, which is called GOLD in Police Command. That is the highest. And it is the Joint Operations Center, Joint Operations Center at Morrytown. And it is police-led. The AIG Operations, which is me, I chair it. We meet weekly on Thursdays, 11 o'clock. And even the Joint Coordination Center, it's split into two layers. There is JCC Level 1, which meets on Thursdays weekly, and then there is JCC Level 2, which meets weekly on Mondays at the same National Operations Center, Morrytown. This body now, with the Level 1, we go and look at this security policy decision taken by these two top layers to discuss and see how it can be operationalized. So we then discuss and try to operationalize it. Since I'm in charge of all the regional police commanders nationwide, we have four regional commanders in the Western area and the Southern Province, Eastern Province, and the Northern Province. I pass on operational directive guidance to them. So discussing at Level 1 and Level 2, we then pass it with specific directions, instructions, how it can be implemented. So we operationalize those decisions, and then we have feedback again coming through JCC 1 and 2 onto NSCCG, onto NSC, the National Security Council, if need be. But like I said, the security arrangement in this new architecture is all embracing. Even the provinces, they have been brought into the security architecture. At the provincial levels, up country, we have what we call provincial security committees, PROSEC, PROSEC. PROSEC, that is provincial security committees. There again, this body, they meet fortnightly to discuss security affecting the region, say like the Eastern region, the Northern region. And there you have membership coming again from the police. The head of the police in that region is a member, the military, other ministries, departments and agencies. And the meeting is chaired by the resident minister. So they discuss security issues. If it is something that is very urgent, police need to action it, they then pass that instruction or information to the police commander there, and necessary action is taken. And then we are then informed through the chain. The commander will inform me. I also inform NSCCG, NSC. Then below that, the province, you have district. Districts, again, we have what we call district security committees, DISEC, D-I-S-E-C. District security committees. This also bring together membership from the police. The police at the district level there, this junior commander there at the district level, the military there with the battalion commander, and all other government agencies there, and other NGOs working in that district. They are all part of that security committee. They meet weekly or fortnightly as and when they want to discuss security issues, development, and other issues about the district. issues they can handle, they deal with it. If they cannot, they then pass it on to the PROSEC, that the Provincial Security Committee. They look at it. If they can deal with it, they handle it and then inform the chain. If they cannot, they then send it to the NSCCG, that meets at State House. So it's discussed at the highest level. If NSCCG cannot handle, it is then sent to the NSC, the National Security Council, until the appropriate remedial action is taken. So as you can see, this is the new security architecture. It's all embracing, all inclusive. This was never before. You know, every department was working on its own, and there was not that coordination, but here there is proper coordination. And like all this I've explained, this you will call the decision and operational aspect. There is also the intelligence side of this security arrangement. You have the intelligence people from the police, from the military, from other agencies. They also meet at State House. It's called the JIC, that is Joint Intelligence Committee. Joint Intelligence Committee. And then you have also the Joint Assessment Team, JAT. Joint Assessment Team, JAT. They meet at State House. They bring together all information, intelligence, and process it. And if they see merit in that, then they pass that intelligence to the NSCCG. If it needs to be action, is then passed to JCC for it to be operationalized. So you can see most of the operations are intelligence-led because of resource constraint. You cannot be going to do condon and search for arms and ammunition all over this city. If it is intelligence-led, you do targeted operations. So the new architecture, it has policy decision layer, and it has operational layer. It also has intelligence layer, and it's there's very good harmony and coordination and integration. And probably it's because of this architecture that is responsible for our success in policing the 2007 parliamentary and presidential elections. Because every day or every week we'll discuss the election at the highest level, we'll go down to JCC, we'll discuss at the provincial, at the district level, we'll discuss, and there's ongoing threat assessment, risk analysis, and see where there would be problems, and we take the proactive preventive action. So this is how we've been working together, and that was why we succeeded. And again, we'll be having the local government elections on the 5th of July, and it is the same thing. In fact, there's ongoing threat assessment and planning and discussing together. And during electoral times, when we have, say, a month or so to any public election, the head of the National Electoral Commission is also co-opted as a member of the NSCCG to be briefing on electoral matters, where the risks are, where the security is threatened, so that we can come in to support the commission to make sure that proper security is provided for the elections.
If you wish, we'll come back to some of the challenges on the operation side, but before, I'd like to come back for a second to one of your first roles as part of the restructuring, which was the census that you mentioned in 1996. The headcount of the police. Give us a short account, a brief account of how did that the decision was made, and how did you go about the task of conducting a census, national census of the police?
Right. By then we had 96. We had a democratic government in place. And the government was concerned about the welfare and the salary conditions of police officers. And at that time, the records section, I would say it was that chaotic. Every time you ask for the actual strength of the police force, they give you one today, tomorrow is another one. And the government was not happy. You see, well, now if I'm going to make some effort to see how I can improve your conditions, either accommodation, barracks, I need to know the exact number of officers. So that was why how the need for a census came about, for government to know the exact number of police officers, and also the police administration by then to know the exact number of police officers by location, so that efforts could be made to see how they can take care of their welfare and other conditions. So I was given that task. And by then, the war was also raging in the provinces. So it was very challenging task, because some of the locations were still rebel lines. You go there, it's only God's grace that you do not fall in ambush. So I tried very hard, and I was able to do that with my team, to get the exact number of police officers, men and women, even laborers, by location, prepare the report, and submitted the report. And unfortunately, by the time I finished the whole exercise, it was now early 2007. I submitted the report today, and before it was forwarded to government to have a look at and see what could be done, then we had a coup, the coup 25th of May 2007. So the government was overthrown, and then you had the rebels came in
1997.
Yeah. So by the time I finished, 1996 had gone, and then
so it took a year to go. And were you going to each?
Yes, I was going to each police location nationwide. Mm-hmm. I was going and physically counting them, taking their bio data on the special form which I designed, the questionnaire, and the work experience, and all details about them. It took about 4 to 5 months to do that, 4 to 5 months. But it started late 1996, and by the time I
finished
everything.
Were there pictures taken of the officers or no?
No.
What were the modes of identification?
Well, it's more than identification, because police, we have our force number. That is very unique. Everybody has force number, and even the PIN number, the payroll PIN number is very unique. So we are doing that. And they were in uniform. Those that were not in uniform, they have their police ID to be identified. So that was completed, but the government did not action it, because that military coup came in 1997, May, and it was protracted. You know, the rebels came and merged with some of the military, so it was never actioned. And again, that compounded the problem. By the time the war was declared over in 2002, most of our police officers, some had been displaced as refugees in other countries. Quite a lot of them have been killed, you know. So, in fact, at the moment, management, we have decided that we should get a project team together to do a core review, to do an establishment review alongside with another headcount. You know.
And that was in what year?
What we are planning now. That's right. We've taken that decision at management meeting last week to do a core review, do an establishment review, because after the war, a lot of new communities have come up, and everybody wants police post, police station here and there. So we want to do that core review to know our actual core functions, to know the establishment, number of police officers we need in each community, so that we can then approach government for funding to recruit more police officers. And also, alongside that, the personnel, my colleague Charlie in charge of personnel, to get a team to do headcount, so that we know the current exact number of officers. Because the attrition is really giving us problem. Every now and then, police officers are dying. You know, more so, the rainy season is here, the cold from pneumonia. And also, we are really losing quite a lot. And again, some are leaving the organization because the salaries are very small, conditions not quite attractive. So when they see jobs elsewhere, they leave. So the attrition is really high.
Another area where you've had a lot of experience is the enhancing external accountability of the police. And you mentioned that you, under the Police Commissioner Kisbil back then, you were tasked to set up the CDIIE.
That's right.
So the Internal Investigation Department and Complaints.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit more also about that experience and the lessons maybe from this?
Right. When the Kit Bidu and his colleagues came to do, and they were given the task to reform, to restructure the police, they also appointed a handful of senior officers, including myself, What we did was to do an analysis, a reflection on the past policing environment in Sierra Leone and the current situation. And from those analyses, it was found out that on reflection, the police had lost the public confidence. Public had no confidence in the police, and we had lost our corporate image. And in fact, the public did not want to work with the police. What was responsible for that? During the wartime, there was massive indiscipline, and most of the police officers were unprofessional, and some even they were maltreating people, and they were very brutal, you know, and very unprofessional. So that angered the public, and we lost the public confidence and support. So the restructuring team then thought that an institution or department or some mechanism should be put in the reform process that would really show the public that the police is now changing and is going to be a people-friendly police, and not that one that was a partisan in discipline and was out there harassing and abusing the human rights of people, and that if people want to complain the police, what can they do? Where can they go? So that was how the idea came about. So I was given that task, and with some advisor from UK again was working with me, Peter Hughes. So we set up this police complaint discipline and internal investigations department, basically to look after force corruption, because we realized that there was the past massive corruption in the force, and that was again responsible for the unprofessional conduct of officers and being unfriendly to people, because when they want money from them and they do not want to give them, they will force them. So it was looking after force corruption in the police force, and also looking after discipline in the police force, and also to provide a friendly, easily accessible platform for members of the public who have been aggrieved, who have been offended by police officers, to come and make complaint. So that system was set up, and when it took off, we did a massive sensitization informing the public about this department, that they should not be afraid, they should come forward to make their complaints against unscrupulous police officers. So the few that started coming, like an experiment on the part of the public, they came, they saw, we investigated, and we kept informing them the progress of the investigations. And at the point when we are convinced there was adequate evidence, some we tried in our police discipline court, and the complainants will come and give testimony, they testify, and they will listen to the hearing. And some of them were reduced in rank, some dismissed. And those complaints again from the public, at the end of if it was that serious and criminal in nature, we charge the police officers to the open criminal court. We charge them to court, and the complainants will go and testify. And at the end of the day, even very senior police officers, by then some were even more senior assistant commissioners, superintendents, were charged to court, the open criminal court. They are tried, convicted, sent to prison. So that started bringing the public confidence. They say, oh, yes, the police is changing. Yeah, we can.
That was
go
in what year? In 2000?
Yes, it all started in 2000, and then we started growing the public reassurance and confidence building, you know. So we even came in with a discipline regulation. So they saw that those infractions that did not amount to criminality, but there was indiscipline, incivility, we tried in our discipline court, and we disciplined the officers. Some were reduced in rank. So, and the outcomes, the statistics, will inform the nation every week at a press conference. That was one thing again we did. We engaged the media, and we were very transparent. We informed the nation what was happening, the reports made, the outcomes, and the officers. We published their names. So that started building back. We started regaining the public confidence, the corporate image we started, and then the people started accepting us. You know, then we said, okay, we change our policing style. Before, now we are like reactive and sit-down policing. If we say, if you have your problem, you should come to the police station, you come and complain. And when you come, the police officers will ask you for money to buy pen, to buy paper, to buy this, or money to pay, to get transport to go to the scene. So we said, no, all of that, we're going to ensure that government provide. So that you come to the police, don't give money to any police officer to buy pen and paper, to transport, don't give money. And if any police ask you, come and report. You know, so we maintain that, and the public saw we are providing all of this. Unfortunately, the defeat project we had by then, they provided us huge vehicle fleet. So we had a lot of vehicles, operational vehicles, taking care of that. So the people then became very confident. We said, okay, now we'll work with you. We'll not just wait for you. We'll now go to your doorsteps, to your communities, sit and discuss policing issues with you, the problems you have in your communities. We'll all sit together, brainstorm, and see how we can address them, where we think you also can support the police. So we then said local needs policing, which is a form of community policing, that policing that meets the needs and expectations of the locals, and but reflecting national standards, you know. So we started having a lot of community forum, going to the communities, discussing with them. We have information officer when engaging members of the community, and we even made it a policy that every local command unit, every police unit, the head of that unit should, on assuming duty, scan his environment, identify those institutions or personalities, and try to bring them to form what we call the Local Policing Partnership Board. Local Policing Partnership Board. So this body, it brings members of that community, you know. They will decide on the timing, whether it's fortnightly or monthly. They come and sit with the local unit commander, with the police, discuss problems in their community, crime problems and other issues, and see how they can work with the police to make sure that their communities are safe and secured. So it's been a policy, and all nationwide, all the police formations, they have this arrangement. And some have even gone further to break it down to smaller groups, what they call area policing partnership board, into smaller groups, so as to create more opportunity for a wider public engagement and involvement in the policing issues. So all of that have convinced the public. They said, oh, now the Sierra Leone police is a changed police, is a force for good, is a friendly police. And they saw we are not compromising on complaints made to us, and we are disciplining our own officers. And in fact, every year we do a perception survey, and we do an internal, we get some NGOs, sometimes CARE International or some other outside organization to do it for us, because we do not want to do it people for the result not to be given credence. So we pay some external institutions to come do an internal perception survey, the organization talking to junior officers, and one about our service delivery, about corruption, how is this level of corruption, the level of discipline, supervision, command and control, everything. And then they go to the public now, you know. They go to the public, and at the end of the day, they put together a very comprehensive report for us. Crime stats and their perception surveys, what the people feel about us, how we are performing. And where we think we are not doing well, then we try to improve on it, because every year we do what we call strategic development plan, and we keep the, building on that. So we build that into a strategic development plan, areas we did not cover, where the public say we are falling short, even our officers corporately, we are falling short. So in our next strategic development plan, we have what we call strategic priorities. So those areas of shortfall then become our strategic priorities, so that we try to put in more resource and build on them, so that we try to provide better and quality service.
In your current position in operations, what are some of the strategic priorities? What are some of the tasks that you prioritize for the next
right
year or 2 years or even longer term?
Fine. one of the strategic priorities, and it has certain activities for short term, certain activities for medium term, and certain activities for long term. The strategic priority, which in fact is in the national strategic goal number one, that is to make the people of Sierra Leone safe, to provide security and safety for the people of Sierra Leone. Since I'm in charge of operations and national security, and all the operational commanders are under me, looking at the making the people of Sierra Leone safe and secure, we look at various crimes of concern and the fear of crime. If I may give you one example, like late last year and to about January this year or so, there was high incidence of armed robbery. So that was creating a lot of fear in the communities, in the lives of people, and the fear of crime was growing. So that became one of the short-term activities under this strategic priority of making people safe and secured in Sierra Leone. So called all my commanders, several meetings, discussed, and we strategized that we have to bring armed robbery to zero. That's our, though it may be ambitious, but we have to do it. So we all worked together. The intelligence was supporting our operations. And for the past 4 months, no armed robberies. The city is quiet. The provinces are quiet. So a lot of resources we put into that. And currently, again, there is one operation going on. We call it Operation Zero Tolerance. Again, we realized that that was affecting the safety, the security, and the convenience of people. And that is the increase in lawlessness on the part of drivers, commuters, and antisocial behavior. So we have made this a very pressing priority in the short term. Teams have been set up, special task force, and every week now you can see when you move around, you see high deployment of traffic officers in all the place, arresting people moving with vehicles without registration plates, reckless driving, drink driving, and dangerous driving, you know, because people were parking against the traffic. Because you park against traffic, other commuters would be, the road become narrow, and it is a recipe for accidents. So all of these we are arresting. And so if that is ongoing. In fact, some of the drivers were complaining that we are being heavy-handed on them. But we told them, no, we cannot tolerate indiscipline. We cannot tolerate this sort of lawlessness. And like you can see, every month, every week, there is statistics of arrest made and charged to court, Operation Zero Tolerance, because we want to cut down on this indiscipline and lawlessness in the country. And also, again, coming under safety and security of people and communities in Sierra Leone, we have very recently, about 2 months back, come to realize that cannabis, sativa, marijuana, as now is growing nationwide in all the regions, in all the districts. So we took that as a strategic priority again, a quick one, because we know the socioeconomic effect and the crime implications of people smoking cannabis, and even some students now, and people transiting some hard drugs, and we know that this can have they can be complementing to each other. And the way the farms are growing, you know, every drug business is so lucrative, and the fear is if they are allowed to continue and they become highly capacitated financially, they can even raise their army, their own security, like we are seeing in Colombia, and then they can challenge the security. They can bring down government. So that is a threat to the safety and security of people in Sierra Leone. So operationally, we made it a priority. I have drawn a national timeline action plan, and I've rolled that out to all the commanders as operational instructions. because we've done a research nationwide identifying where the farms are, where the cannabis are grown, and where ghettos are. So giving that information to all the commanders, timeline with specific instructions to embark on activities like sensitization, awareness raising in their various areas of operation, targeted destruction of the farms, destruction of the ghettos, arrest and prosecutions, and monthly sending statistics to me, because I put performance indicators to monitor them within the time frame. And then I also report to the National Security Council to see how this menace that is impacting on safety and security, how we are addressing it. So that one is really ongoing and is doing quite a lot. And if you remember, I was telling you about crime stats and perception survey. See? So this we are doing every year, you know, to inform us, public to tell us, because the public are like our mirror. They see or they can really tell us what is wrong with us, where we are falling. So these are the priorities that strategically the safety and security of everybody in Sierra Leone should be enhanced at all time. And where we see new crime trends, certain organized crimes or transnational, then that becomes a subset operational priority, and strategies are put in place to address them very quickly.
All right. Do you have any final comment before we have to wrap up the interview?
Well, the final comment is one, to thank you, Arthur Butelli, and your institution for giving me this opportunity to be part of the archive you are developing now, and to give our own experience how our police force in Sierra Leone, how it was it degenerated into a force in distress, then a force in crisis, and how we are able to bring it round, and today people are saying it's a force for good, and how our entire national security has been restructured, and to have this new architecture that is all embracing and coordinating, and that is really helping us. So my appeal here is to my colleagues in the diaspora, in some other nations who do not really have this novel coordinated security architecture, to see how they can also bring that in their security arrangement. Because today, the world is a global village. If there is a problem in one country, though our matter is far away from Sierra Leone, but it has some effect. You know, we are in a global village. So we are ready at all time to share our experience, and personally, I'm ready to share my experience with anybody. And I'm now working on the local government elections, and security and operations and safety of everybody in Sierra Leone is my concern. And Sierra Leone is very stable, is very peaceful now. We are consolidating the peace, and investors wanting to come to invest in Sierra Leone, let them come. Security is here, and the country is very peaceful. So thank you very much. And maybe again, if the Princeton University or DPKO, UN, if they want to maybe tap into my experience, I am at a disposal at any time to work in the UN mission or anywhere. I'm sure the government and the head of the police here can give some time off for me to work and share this experience in the UN missions or some other organizations. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Oshambegwe, thank you.